telling the story of the past 500 years that you could kind of categorize as a subtraction story, as a story of things being taken away and secularism kind of just emerging from underneath the rubble. So 500 years ago, everyone's part of the church, everyone's natural instinct, this is very simplistic, but it was to believe in God. But church gets taken away, and faith gets taken away, and secularism is just kind of what's lying there underneath the whole time. This is kind of, if you grew up when I did in the noughties and 2010s, the kind of story that New Atheism told, that we have grown up and taken away faith in the church, we no longer need those things, and secularism is just kind of the natural way the world is. That's one way of telling the story. This morning we're going to look at a very different way of telling that story. It comes from the thinking of this guy. He's a Canadian Catholic philosopher called Charles Taylor. He wrote this book called A Secular Age. It is very thick and very impenetrable to read, but it is the kind of foundational text for lots of thinking about what it means that the West is secular. It is really hard to read, so thankfully, Christian philosopher Jamie Smith wrote this book, which is called How Not to Be Secular, which is him reading and trying to condense and understand a secular age. This is also quite hard going. If you want an even easier read, the first two chapters of this book, which is called Disruptive Witness by Alan Noble, I think is the best kind of potted. It's called A Disruptive Witness by Alan Noble. This is the best potted version of lots of the stuff I'm about to say. This guy also helpfully brings in how kind of developments of technology interface with some of this stuff, which Taylor doesn't really deal with. The second half where he's trying to suggest what the church should do, I have more questions about, but that's where I'd point you if you have any questions after today. Taylor's really trying to engage with this question. Is that subtraction story the way we've got to where we are right now? Or is there a different story, a better story, a more true story? And he's trying to answer that question of how we got here, but also what it feels like to be here. Well, what does it feel like to believe, to go about life in the West in the 21st century? But firstly, to kind of talk about what it means to be secular, that we are in a secular age. We need to understand what secularism is. Taylor has three definitions. Firstly, there's the idea of secular as the secular versus what is sacred. This is kind of where the term secular came from originally, and the idea that some things in society, things related to the church, were sacred, and the rest of life was secular. I think these kind of come out with the papal reforms in the 12th century. The idea that there are sacred things and secular things. So this isn't necessarily about belief in God. People were engaging with secular things while still much believing in God. There was a division was made between the secular and the sacred. Secularism too, second definition, would be secular as non-religious. This is probably the definition that we're most familiar with. So when people will say that the West is secular, we often understand that to mean that the West doesn't believe in religion, in God, in the transcendent, in the supernatural. But Taylor comes up with a third definition, and this is really what he's interested in and what he thinks defines our age. And he thinks secularism is a shift in the conditions of belief where belief is contested. So it's not necessarily a shift in what we believe in, but how we believe in what we believe in. The manner in which we believe, the ways we view ourselves and the world, which shape what we believe. So the two questions are, how did we get here? And what does it feel like? We're going to spend most of our time in the second half, because I think it'll be more fruitful for us. But we're going to briefly flick through some of that first question, because I think this is helpful to you. Taylor's argument is that it is not a subtraction story. The way the West has got to where it is now isn't just that church attendance and faith in God and things were taken away, but there were shifts. There were changes that happened over those 500 years or so that fundamentally transforms how those conditions of belief, how we view ourselves and view the world, and the position from which we believe out of. As we go through this stuff, some disclaimers. A, this is just the thinking of some bloke from Canada, so we can disagree with what he's saying. This isn't scripture. I think he's mostly right and mostly really helpful, but you're allowed to disagree and push back on what we're going to say. Also, this is my reading of some of this and James K. Smith. With a book that big and philosophical, you're going to have different ways of reading and interpreting it. So don't take this as exactly what Taylor says. This is my engagement with it, filtered by some other people's engagement with it. So just bear that in mind a little bit, T. Thirdly, there's a real temptation when we go through this stuff to read in a kind of moral judgment on the changes that have happened. And I just want to halt. Taylor's not necessarily doing that. I'm not necessarily doing that. All he's trying to do is try and describe what has happened. Some of us will naturally think the way things were before was better than now. Some might think things better. That's okay. We might disagree on those things. I think it's a mix and a mess. But what we're doing here is describing what's happened rather than trying to say everything was better then, everything sucks now, or the other way around. So what has changed? What are the shifts in the conditions of belief that allow a society like the one we live in today to exist that mean that doubt is the norm today, whereas belief was the norm 500 years ago, where believing in God was the natural thing to do. Now doubting God seems like the natural thing to do. How did that happen? A number of shifts. Firstly, a shift in how we view the self. Taylor calls the self, the view of the self 500 years ago, the porous self. Imagine a sponge full of holes. The idea is that the self was viewed as being open to the world, fundamentally open to external forces, whether that be supernatural or otherwise, fundamentally open, porous. Things from outside of us could affect us on a supernatural level or a natural level and change us, have power over us. Taylor says there was a shift over those 500 years from seeing the self as porous to seeing the self as buffered. Right, that's a big wall drawn around the self there. To seeing the self as actually fundamentally a separate thing, really, from the world around us, particularly the kind of psychological self. We no longer view ourselves as fundamentally vulnerable to powers beyond us, but we kind of, at least my experience of the world, is seeing my kind of psychological self as really quite separate and buffered from the world around us. So the porous self to the buffered self. Taylor says there's a shift in how we view time. This is a very wiggly line that I hand-drew on PowerPoint. Hope you enjoy that. Taylor says that in a pre-secular worldview, time was not seen as flat, but had high points. There were moments in life, in community life, in societal life, of high time. Whether that was kind of weekly rhythms of mass or whatever, or bigger celebrations, there were moments of life that were naturally, time-wise, imbued with more meaning and value than others. And over those 500 years, that has been done away with. Time now is linear and flat. Those times of high time, of heightened meaning, don't really exist anymore. Third shift, of many, is how we view ourselves in the collective. See, 500 years ago, the natural belief would to be see yourself as fundamentally embedded in the community around you, to understand your place in community as one of the primary ways you understood yourself, and see your embedding in that particular place in society as divinely given, as connected to how God had structured society and the world. There was a supernatural undercurrent to your embedding in community, and you believing the same things as your community. We've shifted from that to an individualism. We now fundamentally view ourselves as individuals. We might ascribe to particular communities, largely because of how they validate our identity as individuals. We'll think about that a little bit later on. But we no longer see ourselves fundamentally as parts of community. We fundamentally see ourselves as individuals. What's next? The shift from an open universe to a closed universe. So again, much like the self, the view 1500 was that the universe was open to external forces, to the supernatural. God was constantly doing stuff, getting involved, interacting with the world from outside it. And it shifted to a view of the world which was also closed, kind of like the self being buffered. So you get shifts happening in history, like the emergence of deism, what lots of the kind of founding fathers in the Americas were. They believed in a God, but basically that he'd set up the world as a closed system that kept running on the same rules, like flipping the first domino and just letting it all run. And he was no longer actively, imminently involved in the world. to the view of the world going from open to it being its own closed system. Again, you can see there's lots of similarities to some of these shifts. Here's another one, the view of morality changing. So the view of thinking what is good and pious and moral, going from being primarily in how that related to God and how God viewed what was right and wrong, to an understanding of morality that's primarily about the good functioning of society. Notice you can do that shift and still be a religious believer, right? You can still believe in God. But the framework for morality shifted from being primarily about God and the transcendent to primarily being in relation to the functioning order of society. Taylor is a philosopher. He loves coining terms and making up new words. So he calls that the modern moral order. Morality for the flourishing of society. Finally, and this kind of sums up lots of this, this is fundamentally a shift from meaning being something that's external that we can encounter to meaning being something that is constructed in our heads. So meaning prior was embedded in the world around us, whether that's kind of through supernatural relics or through those ceremonies or through particular places and people. Meaning was out there to be encountered. And there's a shift in viewing meaning as something that is constructed mentally. Meaning doesn't really exist in the world. It is just something that happens as a result of my thought processes. And Taylor calls that shift that we've become disenchanted or disenchantment. He doesn't necessarily mean that the West believes less in the supernatural. He's talking about that the meaning has retreated from the world into the mind. Those are some of the shifts he talks about. Why those shifts happen is a bit more complicated. I just probably feel the less equipped to engage with him on that topic, and I have the most questions about whether he's right or wrong about why he thinks those shifts have happened. But I think they have happened. And I just want to recognize that they are shifts. When I first read this stuff, really empathized with these descriptions of how we encounter the world. And it was super helpful to me to see that these shifts haven't kind of happened naturally, but they have been constructed. I think there's a tendency as believers, and we'll come back to this again later, to think that we are the ones who believe in something, and everyone else kind of outside the church just has the kind of natural way that humans view the world. That non-religious people are normal or natural, and we have a kind of the constructed framework for reality. And that's just not true. On these fundamental levels, humans can view the world in such different ways, and there's been such a shift in the last 500 years on these fundamental levels of how we view the universe and ourselves. And it's just really helpful for us to realize that those things are constructed and they have changed, and that no one is neutral on these things. The second thing I find this helpful is that it impacts us as believers. And Taylor's argument in how he does some of the history is that as these shifts were going on, the church kind of retreated to follow suit and to make its arguments within these shifts rather than resisting them. So the church begins to argue in kinds of the ways of the closed universe rather than in the kind of 19th century, rather than arguing that God is active and impacting the world in an open sense. Or we begin to primarily argue that morality is about the flourishing of society and what's good for us, rather than about its relationship to God. Now, both of those things are true. I think both of those things are true. But the church has often shifted to adapt within these framework shifts, rather than trying to challenge them in a biblical way. It's also not necessarily true that all the ways things were before were biblical and helpful. So I don't know, the community thing sounds really exciting for us as lonely 21st century people. But if you're if you disagreeing with your community is seen as a fundamental threat to the community, that's where you kind of get strong laws against heresy and stuff. Because if you are so embedded in your community that if you believe something different, that's not just you believing something different, but a threat to everyone. The shift actually to a view where you're allowed to believe your own thing again, some ways allows for secularism to exist, but also allows for people to become Christians out of their own free will and out of their own individual, like, personal commitment to God, which, I, again, there's good and bad all mixed in here. Let's keep going, and then we'll stop in a second. Okay, if those are the shifts, let's tie some of that together. Taylor says, what does it feel like to believe now? What does it feel like to believe? What is the framework for belief in the 21st century? He's writing this in 2007, based on content that he'd done over the past kind of 10, 15 years before that. What does it feel like to believe? Well, we have those kind of ground level things framing how we view and encounter the world. So disenchantment, the retreat of meaning into the mind, the buffered self, the kind of view that, the way you experience the world, that your psychological self is the most real thing, and that it is separate to the world around you, and the kind of imminent, what Taylor calls the imminent frame. So the idea that these shifts prioritize and frame our whole understanding of reality by what is imminent, what is material, what we can see, touch, feel, what we can physically interact with. Those things are what frame our understanding of reality. Those are the things that feel the most real to us. You might say, yeah, that's just how humans are. I don't think it is always how humans have been. Again, prior to these shifts, I think the supernatural was very much real and very much everyday and very much normal in how people understood and viewed reality. We have an imminent frame, even as believers, I think. What is, we can sense what is imminent, feels the most real. And society is structured in its stories to, I think, reinforce that imminent frame. So that's the kind of ground level, which, again, I just massively feel that. I feel all three of those things in how I interact with the world, even as a Christian believer, and how I understand my own, how I process the world, how I view myself. Okay, that's the ground level. What do people actually believe in? Because people still believe in something, even if secularization 3 has led to more secularization 2, right? More people not actually believing in God. There is still a story that the West tells. In fact, it's impossible for us to live without a story. So there's a level up from these beliefs, which again, I think impacts all of us. There's a narrative that we exist in the West that has emerged out of these conditions and out of the philosophy of the last 200 years. It's a story of expressive individualism. Taylor says, starting in the 1960s, we entered the age of authenticity, he calls it, where this story of expressive individualism is the norm. The story of expressive individualism is this story. It's the story that inside you there is a true and good and perfect self, but that self has been restricted and oppressed by forces outside of you. So the greatest good for you to do in your life is to express that authentic self, to be true to yourself. That shapes how the West views the world, the narrative that the West tells us we should live our lives through. It shapes the things we believe are believable, and Taylor calls that your social imaginary. And it's shaped by the stories we hear. See, this story of that being true to yourself is the greatest good is everywhere. It's the plot of literally every Disney film. The classic one that preachers like to pull out because it's funny that they're quoting Frozen is to quote, "Let it go." That the hero song in so many Disney films with the Disney princess is just telling this expressive individualism story. So Elsa sings, "It's time to see what I can do to test the limits and break through. No right, no wrong, no rules for me. I'm free." If you like Mulan, she sings to the mirror, "When will the mirror show who I am inside?" If you like Moana, the song where she's singing to the sea, she wants to leave her community behind and go explore the sea because that's where she feels called to. Right, it's just this story over and over again. And if you're a guy and you're feeling smug because you're not into Disney princess, it's in superhero films too. I think literally every Spider-Man film, at least all of Tom Holland's, is basically like Spider-Man learns to be his true authentic self. He learns to be Spider-Man on his own terms, not defined by anyone else. This is from Avengers Endgame. This is Thor's mum. Thor's depressed because he lost the battle in the last film. And Thor's mum says to him, "Everyone fails at who they're supposed to be, Thor. A measure of a person, of a hero, is how well they succeed at being who they are." This story is everywhere. This is the story that the West has been telling since the 1960s. It is the way that the West frameworks what we think the good life is. And I think as Christians, we're not immune from the telling of this story and framing how we view our faith and how we view the world around us. Noble says that the way this affects truth is that people approach truth like trying on outfits. We might think we're doing this, evaluate truths based on the logic and evidence behind them anymore, but we evaluate truth based on how we think it fits us. Like you might try on a jacket, see, does this suit me? You might take up hockey, does playing hockey suit me? Does going to church suit me? Does it seem to fit my true authentic self? And faith within an expressive individualistic framework gets framed then as a kind of a quest, a kind of adventure quest where you like find your true self through God. Again, that's not necessarily wrong. It's definitely true that you do find who you really are when you come to God. It's not necessarily the big story of yourself in the universe, though. It's also, interestingly, that Noble uses that metaphor of trying on clothes to describe how we approach truth, because Taylor talks about how we approach fashion actually being an evidence of this shift, of this story happening. The fact we view clothes as an extension and an expression of who we are, rather than seeing them as indicators of community or class, like they might have been historically. I just think that's quite interesting. So there's a real reality that you could be here today as a Christian within this framework. And you've come to Jesus because you think Jesus lets you be your true authentic self. But again, that's not necessarily wrong. But Jesus wants so much more from you from that. And I think what's the danger of that story is that it places you still at the center of it, rather than you being won over to the glory of the risen Christ and coming to submit and live under his kingdom and being part of his even bigger story of reality. I think this also impacts how we approach spiritual practices as Christians. I remember in the past, meeting up with a student, he told me he was struggling to pray and read his Bible in the mornings because he didn't feel authentic to him. He didn't feel like in his deep heart he really wanted to do that, and he didn't want to be inauthentic. That's relatable. But his authenticity value was so high that he thought if he wasn't being authentic towards God and did those things anyway, then he shouldn't do them at all, rather than maybe seeing those things as things that could help shape his heart, actions could influence what he felt as authentic. Obviously, if this is a big story, it also has an impact on how we share the gospel. I think there's a danger, which I definitely have fallen into in the past, as presenting the gospel as within this story of doing, as I've just said, of preaching Jesus as the one who lets you be your true self. And I just think that's dangerous, again, because while it's speaking the language of our culture, it is keeping people within this narrative where their true self is really God, rather than calling them to come to Jesus as their Lord and Savior. It doesn't mean there's not parts of the story that we might want to interact with, but I think we really need to recognize the domination of this story, whether individuals believe in it or not, and then help people have the eyes to see the water that they're swimming in, help them see the stories that they're in, and then call them to the better story. It also means that when people encounter evangelism, they're encountering the sharing of the gospel within this framework. Noble talks about this, I think quoting a different Taylor article, that within this framework, debate and argument is part of how you self-actualize, part of how you present and enact your authentic self out into the world is through argument and debate. So when people and when we hear Christians sharing the gospel, we're not necessarily experiencing that as people making logic arguments about what they should believe about the world. They can experience that as Christians just expressing their authentic Christian identities. I remember an event, University Events Week at Canterbury. My boss at the time did a talk on evidence for the resurrection. I was sat next to a guy, and he said, I asked him at the end what he thought about it, and he said, yeah, that was really interesting, but kind of you've got your thing, I've got my self-improvement thing. That's what it is. And I had a nice conversation with him, but inside I was like, mate, she just said that a man came back from the dead. You're allowed to disagree with that. You're allowed to think that's crazy. You're allowed to reject that. Like, that's a mental claim. But his framework for experiencing that talk was, this is the Christians being Christians, and they've got their Christian thing, and that's good for them, and I've got my thing, and that's good for me. Now, I think that talk did go on to cause him to have some good friends, where he's reevaluating good conversations, where he was reevaluating stuff with his friends afterwards. So there's a need, I think, why Alan Newell's book is called Disruptive Witness. I think there's a need to try and disrupt this framework for understanding ourselves. And call people up towards Jesus. I was going to break for discussion, but I think I'm running low on time. So we will do all the discussion at the end, and I'm just going to keep plowing through. So stay with me. So we have framework, buffered self, disenchantment, imminent frame, all the stuff we were talking about earlier. This story is being told to us constantly, the story of expressive individualism. Honestly, so many films are about something else, and the last act, it suddenly becomes about this, and I'm like... There we go. What does it feel like, again, to believe in this? What does it feel like? Not what do we believe or how we believe, what does it feel like? Well, again, rather than the West being characterized by a lack of belief in God, Taylor argues that there's actually been what he calls the Nova effect, a supernova explosion. Because of these changes, it's enabled an explosion in the number of possible ways that you could structure and order your life, that you could try and live for fullness, for meaning, for all that kind of stuff. There's been a Nova effect explosion. Theologian Dan Strange likes to say that it's not just that we're disenchanted, but we're diff-enchanted. There's just a massive explosion in possible ways that you could live your life and do your life. As the worlds get more connected worldwide, I think that's increased even more. And that leads to a number of things. Most of all, a kind of fragilization in how you hold on to your beliefs. When you're so aware that so many people view the world differently to you, that causes a fundamental change in how you hold on to what you believe. And I think it is part of what makes doubt the norm. People are just less able to hold on to their beliefs as strongly because we're so aware that people are living so differently to us. So belief now is characterized by fragilization, caused by that Nova effect. He also says it's characterized by a sense of malaise. He's really just like trying to describe a feeling here. But I think it's there, and he thinks it's there. He's trying to say that there is just a sense in the West that something's wrong, something's just a bit off. There's two kind of things he says that might lead to that. The first is loss. The sense that we have lost something by going on this journey. We have gone on this journey. Doubt is now the norm, and we can never really get back. And there's just a psychological sense that we've lost something. And the second is flatness, this retreat of meaning into the mind, the flattening of time, the buffering of the self, the closing of the universe, results in just a much more flat interaction and experience of the universe. Malaise, fragilization. He also says we're cross-pressured. It's not necessarily that we don't believe, but we're caught between being pulled in different directions. Between enchantment and disenchantment, between transcendence and immanence. So I think this is James K. Smith. He describes the secular age in the age in which believers are tempted to doubt, but doubters are tempted to believe. We're all kind of caught in this cross pressure, being pulled in different directions. And there's a number of things that cause that. I think this sense of being cross pressured, of this kind of quote, is again around us in society if you're looking for it. So Smith quotes this from the author Julian Barnes. He has a book called Nothing to be Frightened Of. It's him reflecting on death. It opens with this line, I don't believe in God, but I miss him. I think there's just a lot of a sense of that around us in the world. I love this song from Fleet Foxes called Helplessness Blues. It starts like this. I was raised up believing I was somehow unique, like a snowflake distinct among snowflakes, unique in each way you'd conceive. But now, after some thinking, I'd say I'd rather be a functioning cog in some great machinery serving something beyond me. But I don't know. I don't know what that will be. One of my favorites, Phoebe Bridgers, on her 2020 album, Punisher. There's a song called Chinese Satellite, which opens with these words: I've been running around in circles pretending to be myself. Why would anyone do this on purpose when they could do something else? And in the chorus, he says, I want to believe, but instead I look at the sky and I feel nothing. You know, I hate to be alone. I want to be wrong. Why is doubt the norm both ways? Why are we pulled in both directions? Taylor says there's a number of stories that that our culture tells us which pull us towards disenchantment and towards imminence. He calls them, again, he likes quoting words and cramming up with phrases because he's a philosopher. He calls them closed world structures. These are basically stories that lean us towards disenchantment. The two main ones he talks about that our culture tells is the one of kind of growing up, that the world has grown up and therefore, like a teenager leaving home, has left behind believing in God and the supernatural. That was all kind of childish belief. With progress in science and technology, we no longer need to believe those things. We've grown up and left those things behind. I think that narrative has maybe begun to disappear in the 20 years since Taylor wrote this. Maybe you disagree. The second one, I think, is still here. And is that the story that religious ethics and a religious way of living actually attacks the self and ignores nature. You can see if you believe in a buffered self, expressive individualism, a closed world, moral order, ethics is just for the flourishing of society. And an ethic that calls you to deny yourself and make sacrifices now and restrict yourself now in order for some kind of transcendent afterlife, it's therefore seen as really wrong and dangerous, not just silly, because it actually causes you to restrict that authentic self that you're meant to be expressing, potentially. And the other critique is that it makes you ignore nature, that the look to the transcendent takes your eyes off the natural world, and that's also damaging and harmful. Those are two closed world structure stories that cross-pressure us towards disenchantment. But he says, I don't know why I've got that there. He also says there's cross pressures towards the transcendent. Things in our experience of the world which make people more open and drawn towards believing in the supernatural. The first is questions around purpose. And that's what a lot of the debate around the so-called quiet revival has been about. The narrative has been that it's people searching for purpose and meaning. Not just kind of... meaning itself, but to find something worth being moved and motivated towards. The search for meaning is not something that gives you enough meaning to sustain itself. You need something bigger and better to give you meaning and purpose. Another cross-pressure towards transcendent is around ethics. I think it's very hard and tricky for people to get to their sense of morality just from a natural, exclusive atheist humanism. How strongly we believe in right and wrong is something that cross-pressures us upwards. And the third thing he talks about is beauty. Again, very hard to account for the human response to beauty and aesthetics within a purely exclusive humanist worldview. Taylor says these things pull people towards the transcendent, particularly around time when it's feeling flat, and maybe particularly around moments of change, particularly maybe around experience encounters with death. We're cross-pressured between transcendence and immanence. Okay. What does this mean for us? What might the future look like? I find this really interesting. At the end of the book, Taylor very reluctantly says he's going to try and do some fortune telling and say what he thinks the future is going to be like. He says this. He says, in societies where this is him writing in 2007. He says, in societies where the general equilibrium point is firmly within imminence, where many people even have trouble understanding how a sane person can believe in God, the dominant secularization narrative, that's that subtraction story, which tends to blame our religious past for many of the woes of our world, will become less plausible over time. Right, if your whole narrative for history is that religion was bad and oppressing, causing all the ills in the world, and you take away religion and the bad stuff's still there, the narrative defeats itself. And I think we're seeing that happen. The second thing he says, again, this is super interesting. He says, at the same time, the heavy concentration of the atmosphere of imminence will intensify a sense of living in a wasteland. Again, that's disenchantment, flatness, malleus stuff. For subsequent generations, and many young people will begin again to explore beyond the boundaries. So young people who've grown up in a very secular society, very pulled towards the imminence, disenchanted, flat, will begin again to look to enchantment and transcendent things in order to escape the wasteland of those things. And again, I think we're beginning to see that happen for maybe the exact reasons he describes 20 years after he wrote it. Okay, what does this mean for us? And then we'll have a chance to chat with each other a little bit, and then we'll do some Q&A. Again, I think personally, when I first thought this through, it helped me just understand myself and how I engage with religion, how I engage with God and Christianity. I do think I view the world through a buffered lens. I do think I'm prone and tilted towards an imminent frame. And it was just helpful to see those things and therefore know how to process the thoughts that kind of arise from that. Again, for evangelism, I think we need to be able to kind of name these things and call people out and help them to see that what they're believing in isn't just the natural worldview that just arises from normal life, but is a very geographically and historically and philosophically constructed and situated way of viewing the world, that they do not have. They are wearing a pair of glasses, even if they can't see the glasses they've got on. I think it's really helpful for us to do that for people. I think it also maybe means these kinds of things might be fruitful ways of sharing the gospel to people. Again, not in a way which keeps people in the pursuit of their authentic self or keeps people in a buffered, imminent frame, but to use these kind of connection points to call people out and up into the greater story of the gospel. Maybe we can think about how we might do that. I think that's all I have. I think these things help us to see where some of our thinking might not be affected totally by Jesus. And I think hopefully it helps us to see where there might be connection points for the gospel outwards. Let's discuss for 2 minutes with the person next to you. I'm going to get a Slido up and I'll do Q&A after that. 2 minutes with the people near you. Have a chat. What struck you from that? Anything that you really identify with? Anything that you're like, that was crazy? Any questions that you want to ask? Have a little chat and then we'll do Q&A.